فليلي يا
Théophile Gautier wrote that the pyramids at Giza have been contemporaries of lost empires. They have seen civilizations that we have never known, understood languages that we try to guess through hieroglyphics, known customs that to us seem as fantastical as a dream. They have been there so long that even the stars have changed positions in the sky. Jordan Maxwell has things to tell you about this forgotten knowledge. Jordan Maxwell is a leading authority and researcher on ancient religions and secret societies, their symbols, emblems, fraternal brotherhoods, and how they relate to Egypt. Listen as he shows us the parallels between the ancient Egyptian symbols and their hidden meanings in modern religious beliefs. Please welcome the foremost expert on ancient religions and modern conspiracies, Jordan Maxwell.
Kind of you, but I don't think I resemble that remark. First of all, I want to say thank you for being here with me, and second of all, I want to thank Gouda for allowing us to be in his home. And I would like to say that I'm not going to present myself as an authority on anything, though I appreciate the very kind, courteous remarks. I don't consider myself to be an authority. I feel far better by saying that I'm just an ordinary man in the pursuit of extraordinary knowledge. I'm fascinated by the things which are unseen. I'm fascinated by the spirit that pervades this country. And I feel that it's an idea whose time has come to look at the spirituality that's represented here on the Giza Plateau as opposed to the religion, which is roughly based on it. So much of the work of the people of the book, Islam, Hebrew, and Christian, has been given to us, I believe, in a political setting rather than a true understanding of the spirituality that's again represented here on the Giza Plateau. I have been interested in the work of secret societies and fraternal orders ever since I can remember, because my family had, I think I mentioned this in the beginning when I opened the program, my mother had an uncle who worked in the Vatican Secretary of State's office. And every couple of years when he would come home as a child, I would sit and listen to the discussion with my father and his brothers and the men in the family discussing politics, religion, and commerce. And it became apparent to me that there was a system in operation throughout the world which decides and makes decisions for us. And there seems to have been some sort of a brotherhood throughout the world that decides what we will learn and what we won't. And esoteric information, for the most part, was considered to be information on a need-to-know basis, and we really didn't need to know. All we need to do is what we're told and think what we're supposed to and not cause any trouble. But I had two uncles growing up as a child who were federal judges. They were not mine. They were my mother's uncles. But they were federal judges. I had Catholic priests in the family. I had underworld in my family, Italian family. So I grew up listening to politics, as I said, religion, and big money. I am convinced that there's never been a religious movement in the world that wasn't a little political. There's never been a political movement that wasn't a little religious. I make a very big distinction between religion and spirituality. I believe that that which is represented in this country in its ancient past is totally different from anything that we relate to in our modern day world. In Christianity, we're given to understand that we're looking for a new millennium. I think the very concept of marking time is a comparatively new idea. I don't think the most ancients had a concept of the way we mark time on calendars. I think that was done perhaps politically for religious reasons, somehow or another metaphysically to control us so that we know when we're to do something and when not. But I don't think that the spirit keeps track of time the way we think it does. And I am honored to have Hakim with me today. It is an honor. And I feel I should be listening to him rather than him listening to me. But anyway, the whole subject of the millennium, we are told that very soon there's going to be a big celebration here on the Giza Plateau where all of the heads of state and all the most important people, by their own standards, are going to be here on the Giza Plateau to celebrate the new millennium. All of the most important elites are going to be here. That word elite is very interesting. It comes from an ancient Semitic word for God, El, which is actually goes back to an ancient, far more ancient word, Il, I-L, or I-L-E, or I-L-L-E-S, Ils, the Ilies. The Ilies or the Ils were the gods. And the gods were always to rule from on high. So this is where we get the word hill. They're up on the hill. As a matter of fact, in the Roman Empire, Caesar's seat of power for the Caesars of Rome was said to be up on Capitol Hill or Capitoline Hill. And today we still have people in America who see themselves as gods and Caesars ruling from on Capitol Hill with their Senate. Nothing is more reprehensible to me than political power. I am totally turned off with the word authority. I don't like authority. It implies the word author. And immediately I question who wrote the law. I mean, actually, if you think about it, who said that the Queen of England is queen? What are you talking about when you discuss the divine right of kings? I suspect that it's a consensus reality, that enough people say something long enough and the group begins to believe it, as Hitler persuaded everyone to believe himself to be a god, and after a while the thing sets, and now we have the divine right of the Holy Family or the royal family. I have a particular aversion to the royal family of England. One has no alternative but to have a very ill feeling about the royal family of England when you know who they really are and what they're really doing. But that whole concept of the royal family comes from, Egypt. But the royal family, the concept, comes from this ancient land. And so much of Europe has taken from this country and from this land all of its precepts and concepts, its ideas of music and architecture and sciences, etc., etc., and has rewoven it and given it back to us as the accomplishments of modern man. It only takes a cursory understanding of history to see where the magnificence of the Western world was traced all the way back to this ancient land. we don't have anything in the entire Western world that comes close to one of the pyramids. So as far as I'm concerned, this land is where it all began, and only until you understand this country and its history are you going to appreciate where we are now in the span of time and where we're going. I made this point before, and I'll make it again, about the word understanding. It comes from the idea of standing under a foundation of a thing to appreciate it correctly. And I think that that's what we have to do with the whole subject of this ancient people and this ancient country, is to stand under the foundation to get understanding. And consequently, there is so much we need to know about the ancient world to appreciate how it fits into our lives today. This I leave to those who are better at it, like Stephen, my friend, who can explain these kind of things. But I have always been aware that there is an undercurrent of wisdom and knowledge which has been concealed from our eyes by our masters. And I am one for sure that has had enough of this kind of trickery. I want the truth to be known about this country. One scientist, I don't recall who it was, made an interesting comment that the universe is not stranger than you imagine. The universe is stranger than you can imagine. And the point being is that you haven't learned anything until you understand how the pyramids were built, the geometrics, the harmonics, the well-established mathematics. I don't see how anyone could possibly say that they are well-informed about the modern-day world and not realize the importance that this country has played in the development of Europe and the rest of the world. Incidentally, Europe is referred to as the Old World Order. Architecture, cuisine is referred to as Old World Europe. If you recall that Europe was dominated for some 1,600 years by the Vatican, dominated Europe. All of its politics and religion and commerce was dominated by the Vatican. And that Europe for some 1,600 years has dominated the world. In point of fact, all today throughout the world, business is based on something called UCC, Uniform Commercial Code, which is maritime admiralty law. It is commercial law, the law of the high seas. I am not an expert on any of the subjects I will discuss with you, but I feel so very strongly you should understand some of the basics. That Uniform Commercial Code, which is the, as I said, the law of the high seas, the law of commerce, which guides all corporate law in the world, all corporate business law, is in point of fact based directly on Vatican canon law. So that in point of fact, the entire world of business is dominated by Rome. Most people are totally unaware of the profound significance of the symbols and emblems which are used on national coats of arms, on flags, heraldry, on the symbols and emblems used by governments, national governments, cities, counties. A classic example of important symbols, and incidentally, symbols are very important. If you don't think so, put a swastika on your arm and walk into a synagogue and see the kind of response you get. Because symbols elicit and bring out emotional responses in people. But even more important, symbols have their own spiritual presence. They tell you things. A classic example, as I said, of symbols. In Washington, D.C., we have the the Ben Ben Stone or the Washington Monument, which is an Egyptian obelisk. On the back of the dollar bill, we have a pyramid with an all-seeing eye. One of the interpretations of the Ben Ben Stone or the Washington Monument is a male phallic, and it connects to the Oval Office. And consequently, there is a lot of symbolism in Washington, D.C. that was taken directly from this ancient country. The scriptures, I'm very, very much involved in the pursuit of knowledge based on the scriptures. I believe that the Bible has a lot of very important things to say, but has been hidden from view. And the things which are given to us to understand about religion are just not true. I remember someone saying a long time ago, always trust a person looking for truth. Never trust the one who's found it. The point being is that real divine truth is far, far out ahead of whatever we might begin to understand. Manly Parma Hall, one of my very good friends, said in one of his lectures, if you can intelligently explain to an audience something about God that everyone can understand, then that proves that you don't know anything about God. Because the God that your pea brain could understand could not be the one that created the universe. The one that created all things is far, far loftier than we have given a correct view of. I feel that perhaps it would be best said that I'm a spiritualist. I am taken by the whole concept of the spirit. I've had too many things happen to me in my life that prove to me over and over again that there is another world coexisting with ours. So I have a very high respect for the spirit world. I want to tell you an example of the kind of thing that has happened to me all of my life. I'll give you one example. When I was about 8 years old, one morning, I was born and raised in a little small town called Gulf Breeze, Florida, Pensacola, actually. And all my life, I had all kinds of strange things happen to me as I was growing up, which I took to be normal and natural. It never occurred to me that they were strange. But I woke up one morning about 8 years old, and I was about 5 miles from home in my night clothes. About 2 o'clock in the morning, something like that, I was freezing cold. I was frightened to death because I didn't know how I got there. I was standing on a concrete bridge, an overpass over the train tracks on the west end of town, and I was freezing cold, and I remember standing between the columns because the wind blowing, at least I wasn't standing in the wind, so I'd stand between the columns to keep warm. And wondering how I got there, and I remember distinctly thinking, how am I going to get home? I could run to my grandmother's house, but it's too far the other way. If I'm going to run anywhere, might as well run home. And I'm thinking to myself, I have no money to call my parents. And so as I was standing there, I saw a car racing down the street coming toward the bridge, and it was running red lights. It was a little small town late at night, so it wasn't that dangerous, but nonetheless, they were running red lights. And as they started up the bridge, they came past me. I saw the two boys that were high school kids. I knew them. My family knew them. And two girls in the back seat, they waved at me, and I waved at them. They were speeding. They shot down the other side of the bridge and blew a tire as they reached the bottom. Lost control of the car. I was freezing, standing out here, wondering how I got here, waving at somebody passing by, and the car lost control. I watched it skid across a parking lot, and this is a long time ago, 50 years ago, but to the best of my recollection, I remember it speeding and crashing and hitting cars because it totally lost control, skidding across gravel, and crashed into the front of a coffee shop, a little all-night cafe. I ran across the bridge on the other side and ran down. I remember running across and running down so very fast that I thought if I trip, I'm going to knock my teeth out. And I kept yelling that to myself, don't fall, you're going to break your face if you fall, because I was running so fast. And I ran down and ran across the gravel, and then it occurred to me as I was running that I'm barefooted, my feet are killing me. I ran into the coffee shop. I saw, of course, what you can imagine was nothing but a horrible mess of bodies and chaos. And for an eight-year-old child, I it was far more than I could bear. And I burst out crying. I was totally disorientated. I didn't know what to do. I knew people were hurting, but I didn't know what to do about it. And I remember there was an old man that motioned for me to come over, and I went over and grabbed him and pulled him, and he kept pushing himself as I helped pull him over to the side. I turned around, and even at that time, even at 8 or 9 years old, I had the presence of mind to know that there were some people here you can't help. So methodically look quickly and see who you can help and what you can do to help. And I remember sizing the situation up, and I was crying, I was hurting, but I realized that these people were in far more trouble. And then I woke up in bed crying, and I was totally ballistic. Took quite a few minutes for my family to quiet me down. And my mother explained to me that it was a very bad dream. I explained to my parents that night everything that I had experienced. The boys in the car, the wreck, all of the details. The next morning in the paper, precisely what I had told my parents happened was in the paper, exactly as I had seen it. This began a life of strange occurrences for me. And it opened up my mind to the fact that we are not here by ourselves. That I've often been asked, well, what did that experience teach you? Or what did you get out of it? It taught me one thing that's indelibly left in my conscience. That someone has the ability to put you where it chooses to put you. Someone has the control to decide where you will be and what you will do. And so while you might think that you have total freedom in your life, ostensibly you do, but in point of fact, there is a divine presence in the universe that guides all things. So I believe that individuals which are here, individuals which are not here, were not supposed to be here. I think that there is a rhyme and a reason for almost everything that happens. The question and I should have prefaced all my comments today by saying that the intelligent, thoughtful presentations that you have heard in the past few days is not what you're going to hear today from me. Today you're going to hear from me the ramblings of a dissatisfied spirit. I'm just very dissatisfied with everything that I see and that I experience in the world around me. I think that so many people are having problems in their lives that could be solved if they knew better how to act and how to deal with these problems. Remember, the decisions you make in your life are only as good as the information. And so if you have faulty information, then of course your decisions are going to hurt you. I mean, this is why the people who run our world have such things as the CIA, a Central Intelligence Agency, because intelligence is required for every movement in your life. You need to know what's on the other side. You need to know where you're going. It would help to know as much about the other, the significant other in your life, before making decisions. So that's why I have pursued this kind of esoteric knowledge, because I believe that there is a world out there that is not in our dimension, not in our domain, but that it, as the ancient people said, I think it was the Knights Templars who coined the phrase, as above, so below. I believe that, that so many things which happen to us is because of something that's happening up there. And someone else seems to be in control. That's my view. One of the questions I have also is the significance of the millennium. We are told, as I've mentioned, we're told that there's going to be a big celebration here on the Giza Plateau toward the end of the year at the stroke of midnight. There's going to be a big celebration here where the capstone will be put on the pyramid. There will be a lot of activity here ushering in the new millennium. I think scientifically that's incorrect. I think the new millennium does not begin till the year 2001. However, we don't let things like that bother us. I mean, it sounds good, 2000, so we'll party like it's 1999. But I don't know that the millennium actually begins at the end of this year. I am convinced and persuaded that the ancients did not keep the same kind of timetables we do. But I do believe that there is something important happening at this particular flow of time. There are changes that are happening that are going to affect us, yes. And this land that we call today Egypt is, I believe, primarily involved in the whole world of mankind and its future. The scripture says in Genesis, let me go back to the Hebrew scriptures, in Genesis, where Egypt is likened unto the garden of God, the garden of the Lord, Egypt is referred to. And that's in Genesis 13:10. In Jeremiah, in the Old Testament, there's a very interesting scripture, Jeremiah 32:20, that says, it's talking about God and all of his wondrous works. He's great in counsel and mighty in works. For his eyes are open upon the ways of the sons of men, to give to each one according to his ways and according to the fruit of his doing. And then it makes an interesting statement in Genesis 32:20. God, which has set signs and wonders in the land of Egypt, even unto this day. What do you mean, signs and wonders in Egypt, even unto this day? And in Israel, and among other men. And you look up the references, other men, and it says throughout mankind. So I believe that God, the divine, the present, the divine presence in the universe, has set signs in Egypt and among other men. When you understand that, there's another interesting scripture that actually is germane to this whole subject, and that's Isaiah 19:20. Keeping in mind that God has set signs in Egypt, the scripture says, Isaiah 19:19 says, in that day shall there be an altar to the Lord in the midst of the land of Egypt, comma, and a pillar at the border thereof to the Lord. For many years, biblical scholars were looking for two separate things here. An altar to the Lord in the midst of the land of Egypt, comma, and a pillar at the border thereof. But the answer was in the next scripture. Isaiah 19:20 says, and it shall be for a sign and for a witness unto the Lord of hosts in the land of Egypt. Blessed be my people, Egypt. we better go back and look at that. And that day shall there be an altar to the Lord in the midst of the land of Egypt, and a pillar at the border thereof to the Lord, and it shall be for a sign and for a witness unto the Lord of hosts in the land of Egypt. And later in 25 says, blessed be my people, Egypt. This altar in the midst of the land of Egypt and the pillar at the border, I believe, and many scholars concur, is none other than the pyramid. For according to the reference books, it seems to indicate that the pyramid is in the middle, at the border thereof. It is serving as a symbol, an emblem, or a sign. And relation to what we have learned from about the Giza Plateau being a power plant, I talk with my friend Stephen about this, that I think that there's more yet to this subject that Christopher was bringing out about the power plant concept of the pyramid. I think he's right on this. But I also believe that we being biological batteries ourselves, we are an electrical unit of sorts ourselves. Our very thoughts are and can be considered to be in the virtual state. I think that there's something going on here on an even higher level with humans and that pyramid. I think that there is some sort of a resonant frequency in humans to somehow or another affect us, probably to open our minds or to open our spirits. So that while we may be talking about a very mundane thing of an electrical power plant, we're also talking about something that very well might be a sign or a symbol, which is an opening for us to move into a different dimension, perhaps. I hold all of these things as a very good possibility. In relation to the millennium, which is about to begin, we're told, the Old Testament and the New Testament talk about the concept of a Messiah. And in the Old Testament, in the book of Psalms, for instance, is one of the three places where the Messiah is referred to as a symbol. There's an interesting symbol used in the Old Testament Hebrew for the Messiah. The same identical symbol is used in the New Testament for Jesus, the Messiah. Let me read it to you. And then I also want to talk about the whole concept of Messiah and its implications for our time, the Messianic era. But in the book of Psalms 118, the Hebrew Old Testament, Psalms 118:22 says, the stone which the builders rejected is become the chief cornerstone. And this is from the Lord and is His doing, and it is marvelous in our eyes. It was talking about the Messiah, and again, the Messiah is referred to as the stone which the builders rejected has become the chief cornerstone. Over in the New Testament, one of the many places in the New Testament that the Messiah is referred to by the same symbol. In 1 Peter 2:6, the scripture says, wherefore it is contained in the scripture, behold, I lay in Sion a chief cornerstone the builders rejected. The reference works show, and again, there's at least three different places in the New Testament where Jesus is referred to as the chief cornerstone the builders rejected. In the Old Testament, Messiah is the chief cornerstone. An interesting fact about this is that the word in Hebrew for chief cornerstone and Greek in the New Testament chief cornerstone simply means a triangle or a pyramidion, triangle perched on top of a pyramid. That is what the word chief cornerstone in the, both the Hebrew and the Greek actually means. So the symbol for the Messiah in both the Old Testament and the New is the triangle or the capstone of the pyramid. Now we're talking Egypt. Now we're talking this ancient land. We're not talking about Rome. We're not talking about the West. We're talking about the East. The sun always rises in the East. Light comes into the world from the East, not the West. The reference works show that the chief cornerstone, meaning the top angle of a pyramid, here Jesus Christ himself is acknowledged as the chief cornerstone. The Expositor's Bible Commentary says that the Greek word for chief cornerstone means, quote, the tip of the angle. Here in Ephesians, it says in the book of Ephesians, Jesus Christ himself being the chief cornerstone. The footnotes has the triangle perched on the pyramid. A pyramidion is, of course, the little pyramid perched to finish off the big pyramid. Now, the point I wish to make is that this is a very important symbol, and it has profound implications for the symbolism that's being bandied around in America. On the back of the $1 bill, you will see the pyramid with the all-seeing eye. Let's see, where is it? We had a picture of the pyramid. Here it is. Of course, the triangle at the top being, as I said, the symbol for the Messiah, you need to understand also that while this might be esoteric Christianity or esoteric Judaism, it is also well understood in political circles throughout the world. And that so much of the elite establishment of world government throughout the world is well aware of the implications of this ancient land and its symbols in the pyramid. So much so that the most important people in the world are coming here to celebrate something called a new millennium. What has occurred to me, a question which I have asked many times, is, does the new millennium about to dawn begin the 1,000-year reign of Christ, or does the 1,000-year reign of Christ begin the new millennium? In other words, according to the Christian tradition, if Jesus is to come back and bring a kingdom, and when he comes back, it will inaugurate a new order or a 1,000-year reign of Christ, then does Christ or Jesus have to wait until the calendar date of the new millennium beginning? Why couldn't he come back 10 years ago? Why can't he come back 100 years ago? Because the concept is that the Lord Master coming back begins his 1,000-year reign, then whenever he comes back, that begins his 1,000-year reign. Or, as the churches in Christendom throughout the world are saying, that the new millennium will begin the reign of Christ. It will begin the new reign of the Messiah. Because if the churches are correct, then what we're talking about is an astronomical event, not a literal Messiah coming back. We're talking about a calendar event, that this Messiah cannot come back until we have a celebration. We have to have the celebration. It has to be on the calendar, and it has to be at the end of the 1,000-year period to inaugurate a new 1,000-year period. Now the Messiah can come back. He can't come back before. Do you understand the point I'm making? Which is which? Does the thousand-year reign begin when the Messiah comes back? Or does the Messiah come back when the thousand-year begins? The point is that the second answer is the correct one. The Messiah is an astronomical term, and that the entire concept and even the old Hebrew tradition of the Messiah was a period of time, a messianic era, a time that would come. And I am respectfully suggesting that unless and until we get our stuff together, spiritually speaking, that messianic era is long yet away from us. Because I don't believe that on this planet we are ready for a messianic era. We haven't even learned how to live with each other, much less live with that divine one who created us. We are in total disarray before our God. It's interesting that the symbol of the triangle has been used all over the world, politically speaking. It's an interesting subject which I have been working on for many years, is the occult or hidden connection between the triangle and the circle and the new dawn or the coming new dawn, of which Aleister Crowley was merely one of many who realized the implications of the subject of the new dawn. If you will go back in your history books and when the Soviet Union was still in existence, you will see that the Soviet National Coat of Arms had a sun rising over the earth with the hammer and sickle and the red star. The hammer and the sickle, incidentally, were separate symbols for thousands of years, and they were only brought together by the communists to cross them. The sickle was always a symbol of Saturn. The Saturnalian symbol, or the symbol for the planet Saturn astronomically, was an upside-down sickle, okay, surmounted by a cross. Rather interesting, I suspect. The symbol of the sickle being Saturn's symbol, the Saturnalian symbol of the planet Saturn, surmounted by the cross, and the hammer being the hammer in the ancient world, was the axe. It became known as the hammer of Thor, the symbol for the ability of the gods to tear down, smash down with the hammer, and to build up with power. So those two symbols were crossed in the communist world. There's a whole story on the planet Saturn and its connections to the Nazi philosophy, the Nazi religious philosophy, the communist philosophy, the fascist. It is a fascinating story about how the planet Saturn has influenced both governments and religions throughout thousands and thousands of years. Symbols. Reminds me, what is the one symbol that was most prominent besides the swastika in Nazi Germany and in Nazi-occupied Europe? The one symbol that was most used and is most reprehensible to anyone who hated that system was a fasci, the symbol of world fascism. The symbol of world fascism, or the fasci, is a bundle of sticks with crisscrossed with a hatchet head. A bundle of sticks with a hatchet head is the symbol of world fascism. It's called a fasci. You will see on the nightly news in America, every night on C-SPAN, almost every night in America, you will see in the congressional room where the President of the United States gives his State of the Union message in that particular room where the Congress and the Senate both sit. You'll see it on television at night. On both sides of the podium, most people are watching the speaker in the podium and listening to his dribble. But no one seems to be aware that on both sides of the podium are two 12-foot-high fascias, the symbol of world corporate fascism. This is, to my way of thinking, absolutely appalling. I'm amazed at how many people do not realize the symbols and the emblems of totalitarian dictatorship that pervade the Western world. And don't ever forget for one moment that the money, the grease, and the power that put Adolf Hitler into power came from America and Britain and Europe. Families with money financed Adolf Hitler. If you begin to, and think back, the older people here will understand what I'm saying. Some of the younger people will not appreciate this, but if you go back to the 30s in Europe, Germany, first of all, was one of the most educated and most highly advanced cultures in Europe. They were not stupid. Germans are many things, but stupid was not one of them. But after the First World War, they were totally broke, as were many nations, including America. That war caused economic hardships for everyone except the guys who made the money. But Germany was absolutely starving in the streets, quite literally. And on the scene came a man who was later to become known as Adolf Hitler. And he began arousing the emotions of the people that we need to clean this mess up. We've been had. We need to get back our greatness that was Germany and bring back the greatness of the Germanic people, etc., etc. And he began promoting himself, and he got elected to a small office and began to grow in power. And about the mid-30s, mid to late 30s, he began to grow quickly. And overnight, from a country and a people that were starving in the streets, in a couple of very short years, Hitler was able to build the largest, most powerful military-industrial complex the Western world has ever seen. Where did he get the money? Okay? Consequently, I am of the opinion that for far too long, we in the West have conveniently overlooked the anti-Semitism which pervades our culture. And how I got on this subject, I don't know, but I have so many things, so many things bother me. This is one of them. This is not only a malady in itself, it is indicative of a continual malady the human race has of racism and hatred for people who don't look like you and a disrespect for people who do not live in your country or go to your church. And consequently, I think that it's about time that we start thinking in terms of a world of people living together and showing respect for each other and for our elders and for those things which are far older than our culture. I think that there's an awful lot of people beginning to appreciate that principle. I mentioned the word church. You know where the word church comes from? So many people are proud to tell you that they're churchgoers. I remember that I got a story that keeps coming up in my mind. I got to get rid of it. The child comes out with his father in front of the church, and he sees a big statue of a soldier in bronze. And the kid says to his dad, what is that statue for? And he said, oh, that's to commemorate the men who died in the service. And he said, which one, the 9 o'clock or the 11 o'clock? So the word church, incidentally, is an interesting word. It's an English word, okay? It's an English word, church. It comes from a Scottish word, kirk. That's why we have one of the old hymns, Kirk of the Valley. Kirk in Scottish is church in English. But kirk in Scottish comes from a Greek word, circe, circe. And Circe in the Greek mythology was the mother Circe, mother Circe, who was able to put a spell on people and to bring them into her house and change men into pigs and eat them.
Did she really have to change
it? Of course. So, I don't know what that tells you. So I'm just saying that it's interesting words. Words are very interesting terms and symbols. I'm fascinated by the world of terms and symbols and words. Anyway, back to this whole concept of the eye and the pyramid, the dollar bill, and why the plateau is becoming more and more prevalent in Western civilization media. And I didn't even finish with the anti-Semitism yet, because I have more to say on that. We're not through with that yet. Interesting, Manly Palmer Hall did a little half a page on the I and the dollar bill, which I would like to read you a sentence or two, because I think it has a very powerful message for us. Given the fact that this is a interpretation in the West, the eye itself being a symbol of the sun in some quarters of the ancient world, the eye of Horus was the eye of the sun. But the whole concept of the sun bringing light into the world is paramount. The whole idea of man being enlightened by the divine presence in the universe, or the sun, what we call the sun, he makes the point that the all-seeing eye represents the eternal watchfulness of the infinite. An apex atop the platform, incidentally, is 30 feet square. That's interesting. Is a symbol of the unfinished work of the redemption of humanity. Imperfect man, incomplete without the apex of his divine nature. The all-seeing eye on the dollar bill is not situated on top of the pyramid, but floats above it. For man has not yet affected his spiritual union with his material self. The pyramid structure represents the building of society to a gradual perfection of human endeavor crowned by the divine. Now, be this an interpretation of Western man or not, I think it applies here. That ultimately, what we as a human species are to work toward is a gradual uplifting in our spirit, in our consciousness, in our intellectual ability to comprehend spiritual things. And I think that this is an adequate symbol for that work that is referred to by the Freemasons as the great work of enlightening the world. As Alan Alford did publicly a few days ago, made a 180-degree turn in his understanding of things, I choose this day to do the same. So I am going to publicly say, and I'm saying it not only for the audience here, but to be on video from this day on, as a witness against me, I am When I have had for the longest time a loathing for the concept of secret societies, because I felt that if what you're doing is important and good, then it should be known by everyone. It shouldn't be a secret society. And then also, when contemplating the basis for modern-day Freemasonry, the Scottish and York Rite Freemasonry of the Western world, the basis for York and Scottish Rite Freemasonry being the British Grand Lodge, the mother Grand Lodge of all Western Freemasonry is the British Grand Lodge, I was not particularly impressed with the British royalty or its Masonic secret societies and orders of power. I believe them to have been racist and having agendas that they have not shared with all of us. And so my feeling was that Freemasonry was something that I was very unhappy with. But in point of fact, I have grown in my understanding to appreciate that at the time that the orders of Masonry were in their infancy in about the 10th, 11th, 12th century, the church dominated, as I said, all of Europe. And it was not a religious institution as much as it was a very powerful political institution that had in mind the domination of the world, whether anyone wished it or not. Therefore, the Vatican dominated, and the Vatican at that time was somewhat different than the Vatican today. Not much, but somewhat. And it was very dangerous, as one politician has observed. It's very dangerous to be right when your country is wrong. It was very dangerous in those days, in the Middle Ages, to speak of and to wish to educate other people and to have an open mind. The brain is like a parachute. It doesn't work if it's not open. But during that time, open minds were not in vogue. There was a power that was accepted throughout the world, and that was the Vatican, the papacy, the church. But at that time, there were those men who were the scientists, the thinkers, the philosophers, and they saw fit to protect themselves by secret associations, which I can understand. And then being able to have a cursory understanding, and I'm looking forward to having a better understanding before I leave, because I have not had a chance to talk with Hakim the way I want to, but having a cursory understanding of the secret brotherhood, of the ancient priesthood, the ancient brotherhood, tells me that true wisdom has been carried down for thousands of years, for millennia, by a handful of individuals that were worthy to carry the wisdom. Because it appears to me now that to give this kind of spiritual wisdom to modern day man or to mankind in general, so many people are not ready to use that kind of knowledge correctly and for the right purposes, and using it in love to help the human family to grow, but would misuse it, as we have seen in America, everywhere in the world that Europeans go, we see the misuse of power and prestige and money. Well, what more powerful tool in the hands of a man than secret knowledge? Wisdom of the ancients. So I am at this moment saying that I have a different view than that which I have expressed before, and I have a high respect for the individuals who have brought themselves into secret association to protect the divine knowledge and spiritual learning, and who want to make this knowledge available to those who are prepared to accept it. Remember that when the student is ready, the teacher will appear. These societies, of which Hakim has helped me to understand, these societies of the priesthood have never kept this knowledge in a clandestine way. They protected it so as to give it to those who were worthy to know, who wanted to know, who were showing the correct spiritual foundations to accept this kind of knowledge. And the wrong hands could be very dangerous. We have found that academic and, what am I trying to say, that technology, academics and technology, without spiritual morality is a very dangerous thing. And so consequently, I, for one, appreciate the spiritual brotherhood who carries the wisdom that we are hoping to receive when we're ready. And again, I pay tribute to my teacher, Kareem, and others who have helped me to appreciate this better understanding of the general subject of secret societies. Now, that is not to say that there aren't societies who are founded for negative purposes. But that seems to be the way of the world. But I am mostly interested now in pursuing that wisdom which I realize has been here from day one and that is readily available to anyone who wishes it, provided, of course, that you have prepared yourself be borne along by that spirit. You cannot go into the mysteries, the ancient mysteries, with preconceived ideas about what truth is. As I said, truth is a very, well, it's been said before me, truth is a very subjective thing. So I consider that this is something that we all need to start thinking in terms of. Putting away preconceived ideas, going before the divine and asking for enlightenment, asking for guidance, and leaving it at that. You'd be surprised what the Spirit can do with you if you just put down all of your defenses and just make yourself available to the Spirit and say, help me to understand, and watch what happens to you. I am also persuaded that going into the Great Pyramid may very well have some sort of a spiritual effect on one. I cannot imagine that all of the tourists who have gone into the pyramid have appreciated it correctly. I think also, and this is just my opinion, since no one asked for it, I'll give it. It is my opinion that the Spirit will give to whomever it chooses, whatever it chooses. For many are called, but few are chosen. The principle being is that it will decide, that divine presence in the universe that men have called God, that one will decide what you will know and what you will have and what you won't. Just as your parents, knowing better than you as a child what you should know and not know, what you should be involved in and not be involved in, we are children of God. We are children of the divine, and I think that that divine presence will decide for us, according to our progress, what we will know and when we will know it. Therefore, I think the wisest thing and the wisest action would be for us to try to the best of our ability to prepare ourselves to enter into a spiritual domain which is very holy. I consider the pyramid, the Sphinx, and this entire ancient land to be holy. I think it is proven by the fact that all of the kings of the world have come to this land. All of the great minds, mathematicians, scientists, philosophers, all the great intellects of the world have pondered the mysteries of Egypt. They haven't found them out yet. So I have a very high respect for this people, this place, and the ability to be this close proximity to the Great Pyramids. It's a little after 11. I have some other subjects I'd like to get into. I want to go back and finish this anti-Semitism thing that I started. I think it is something that we need to look at because it is not only devastating to Semitics, it is also the same kind of thinking, hatred, whatever, is turned against all of us. I mean, there was a quote from from Nazi Germany, one Holocaust survivor, I recall, said something to the effect that when they came for Catholics, I was not a Catholic, so I really didn't care much. And, you know, when they came for the Protestants, I'm not a Protestant, so what did I care? But when the powers that be finally came for me, there was no one left to help to protect me. I think that this is the problem. Too many people have decided that because it doesn't affect me, if I'm not Semitic, it doesn't affect me. When nothing could be further from the truth. The same mentality that would harm the family across the street has no respect for you either. This entire concept of racism, of the manipulation of people, exploitation of differences, needs to be exposed for what it is. I believe that we are different. There are different cultures in the world. There are different mannerisms in people, just as there are differences in women, there are differences in men. But one thing that does bind us together is that this earth is a living entity, and we're not passengers, we're part of the crew. We are part of this divine creation of the earth. And so I think we need to start respecting each other and it a lot better, because if not, chaos is going to reign in this world, and those masters who manipulate chaos will come out the winners. We will be even more subjected to totalitarian dictatorship. I think it's a time for freedom. I love to be free. I don't want to be the handmaiden of a totalitarian dictatorship. And so that's what I'm saying. The idea being is that we need to clean up this kind of thinking across the board, because it's not just anti-Semitism. It's the hatred of different races and different peoples and the feeling of superiority among one group over another. There is no such thing. And with that, I would also add that I get up sometimes like at 4:30 or 5 o'clock in the morning and stand and observe the city awakening. And I see children on the street with little things to sell. And I see tourists pushing them aside. And that hurts me very much. I don't think for one minute that people who are visiting this land should in any way mistreat the people who live here. I think that if nothing else, I would be totally broke because I would give everything to the children. That's my feeling. But I don't think that we should not be that kind of person to look at a child and consider him to be a pest because he's trying to get our attention. I think we ought to show more love and concern and consideration for everybody, and especially the children. Politics. First of all, I have no respect for politics. That's basically what I could say on that. We'll go on to another subject. The very word politics, polis, gives us the word politicians who make policy, backed up by police. I mean, the whole thing is nothing more than some way to control you. I want to give you an example of how clever the people at the top of this world are. There are many things that, and this would especially apply to Americans. I think you will appreciate it perhaps more than Europeans, but it just goes to show you how clever people can be in their wanting to manipulate and exploit people. I am not an authority on this subject at all. I am a novice. And I may have certain facts incorrect, but the basics I want you to understand. In the 1870s, after the Civil War, there was a corporation founded. There is a lot of documentation I can provide for anyone later who wants to get the correct material, but I'm just giving you a cursory understanding. There was a corporation founded, 1870s. It was incorporated in Delaware. And the corporation's name, like Coca-Cola and McDonald's, that corporation was referred to in its corporate papers as the United States. Very clever. And it was stipulated that the employees of that corporation would not be called employees, but would be called citizens. So that today in America, if they ask you if you're a citizen of the United States, what you think they are asking you is, are you lawfully in the country of America? That's not what they ask you. They ask you, are you a citizen of the United States, means, do you, of your own volition, out of your own mouth, testify that you are a franchisee of a foreign corporation incorporated in the 1870s under International Maritime Admiralty Law? Are you, of your own volition, out of your own mouth, making yourself an employee of a foreign corporation called, incidentally, United States? Consequently, rather clever, I suspect. Consequently, that opens up a whole can of worms. It shows that there is a corporation, a company that was founded, and that we are merely franchisees of a foreign corporation. There's all kinds of interesting things begin to come out once you understand the principles. A classic example, terms and words. Are you aware that in the Ballantyne's Law Dictionary, 1948 edition, if you look up the word human being, go to a law library or to a large library and look up Ballantyne's Law Dictionary and look up the word human being. And it will say, see, monster. So you look up the word monster. I wish I would have brought it so I could have shown it to you. And it says a monster is like a man or a woman, but it's a human being, meaning lesser than a man and a woman. Therefore, it cannot inherit land. It has certain things it cannot do because it's not a man or a woman. It's a human being. The whole idea of words and terms, for instance, when you go into a courtroom, why do they call it a courtroom? Why do they say that you are going there for justice when the very word justice comes from the Emperor Justinian? Justinian, whatever his decision was, that was justice. So today we have justice. Incidentally, are you aware of the fact that the word, we have something in America called a system of justice. We have an educational system, a judicial system, a governmental system. How many people are aware that the word system is a Latin word, comes from a Latin word, and the Roman Empire for the sewer? The sewer in ancient Rome was merely referred to in Latin as the system. And so today, in America, we are proud to say that we have a system. And we do. It is a sewer. There's no doubt about that. I am saying that we need to make ourselves aware of words, terms, concepts, ideas, and begin to do something probably you haven't done before. Go back and start researching where words and ideas have come from. You will begin to appreciate that there's an awful lot of things that we take for granted, that we have no idea in the world where they came from, and that somewhere along the line, unless we are ready to acknowledge the fact that true spirituality is not based on Western man's religion, it is not based on Western cosmological concepts, true spirituality must be traced back to its source. And this is why the work of Lloyd Pye was so important to me, because I'm interested to know who designed us the way we are. Who put into us the different factions within ourselves? Who made us like we are, and how did we get here? That's why I appreciated so much of the different speakers bringing out the different points in relation to how we got here, where we're going, and what the pyramids and such things represent. There are so many different subjects that I like rambling on about. I don't think that a question and answer is appropriate, because I really don't have many answers for anything. So I have all the questions. I don't have any of the answers. But at this point, I'm going to... how long did we... about 40 minutes? Okay. I think I will. What now? Oh, yeah. Yeah, if you're tried in a court in an Islamic land, you're under Islamic justice. If you're tried in the Middle Ages under Rome, you were under Vatican justice, church justice system. In America, we have something called a criminal justice system. The implications of the word is that the criminals are administrating the justice. We have a criminal justice system. And if you think that is by chance humorous, understand that the powers that be do not choose words and terms lightly. These people know what they're doing. When they use terms and phrases and symbols, they know what they're saying. I, for one, take them at their word. If they have a symbol that's on a national coat of arms, if they have a word or a term, I mean, why, for instance, do the Roman priests wear black robes and judges wear black robes? Very interesting, black robes. Black was the color associated with the planet Saturn. Green was the color associated with the planet Venus. Red is the color, of course, associated with the planet Saturn. Black is the color... Red. That's why I'm sorry. That's what I meant. Even school children know that. Red. Right. Red is the color associated with Mars. But back to the robe. Why do the Catholic priests wear black robes? Why do you wear a black robe when you graduate from high school or college and university? And where does the word college comes from? Comes from the College of Cardinals. The whole concept of wearing a square black mortarboard goes back to Mecca. The square, the black square in Mecca, which is surrounded by the circle. It has to do with a very ancient symbolism. But how it has been used by the West and misrepresented by the West. If you think about the word court, going back to the judges who wear black robes in courts, the whole idea in a court is like tennis. The whole idea in a court is to put the ball back in the other guy's court. And you do that with a racket, because the whole thing is a racket. Yeah. Yeah, and the very word, if you look up in a legal dictionary, look up the word attern, A-T-T-U-R-N. And attern was used in the Middle Ages for the person who would take property at the instigation of the king or the magistrate. He would take the property from one person and turn it over to another. He was called an attern. And today, that's what attorneys do. They take property from one and give it to another. Cease it to be, I would say, suffice it to say, I have probably a list of people or institutions which I abhor. The top one is attorneys. I have no respect for attorneys. And the reason why is because they have misused their ability and they have misrepresented themselves around the world. They have misrepresented what they are actually representing. When you use the word law, what law? Again, you go back to terms and words, attorneys. There's a very big difference between an attorney or between the word legal and lawful. Things which are legal do not necessarily mean that they're lawful. Why do you have to have a license, for instance? You have to have a marriage license because the state is a part of your marriage and a marriage license. Now, if you find someone that you want to marry, that's wonderful. And if you want to get married before God, that's also wonderful. But you better get a license from the state first. And if the marriage doesn't work, you can go to God, but you're going to court first. Because the whole concept of marriage, the whole concept of contracts, the whole entire idea of business in the world is based on contracts, courts, lawyers. So that the entire world, in the Western world, is based on a contract. This is why there's a difference between being English and British. The word Brit comes from the Hebrew word berith. Berith in Hebrew means a contract or a covenant. And ish in Hebrew means man or men, can be singular or plural. Therefore, berith-ish becomes Brit-ish. The man of the covenant men. What are we talking about? We're talking about a new covenant. The new covenant is, of course, the New Testament of the Bible. The new covenant, or a new contract from God to man to rule the world or to rule the earth. Which brings me back to something I did want to finish and I didn't, and that was the whole concept of God's kingdom. In the year, and again I preface these comments by saying I am not the world's foremost authority, but I will provide you with the material if you're interested. In the year 1213, the Pope of Rome signed a concordat contract treaty with the King of England. In the year 1213, the Pope signed a treaty with the King of England, which said basically this, that since Jesus Christ is the Messiah who owns and all things were created by and through him, therefore all things which exist on the earth and in the universe are owned by the Messiah, Jesus Christ. Since that is the case, then the actual ownership of the earth and all life on it belongs to Jesus Christ. But since he is not here right now, someone needs to stand in for him. And the word in Latin is vicar, which basically means someone who stands in for. So the Pope appointed himself as vicar of Christ, who's standing in for Jesus. Jesus has the right to own the whole world. But since he's not here yet, he's busy right now elsewhere, somebody has to be, the dirty job has to fall on someone, So the Pope decided that he will own the whole world. And you think that's funny? That's the law. That was an actual treaty drawn up in Rome with the King of England. Then the whole earth, with all of its life and possessions, being owned by the papacy for Jesus, being owned by the Pope, was then put into a trust, and the King of England was made the trustee in trust of the trust for Christ. So that the King of England then becomes known as King of Kings and Lord of Lords. Therefore, the papacy, as of even this very day, still maintains that the Pope owns the world, and that the King of England is King of Kings and Lord of Lords, and will remain so until Jesus comes back. And in point of fact, at the coronation of the King of England, the Archbishop of Canterbury said something to the effect, I don't have it in front of me, but something to the effect that the King of England is accepting the position as King of Kings and Lord of Lords for Jesus Christ, and until such time as Jesus Christ comes back to the earth, the King of England is the King of all kings and the Lord of all lords. A rather adventurous position to put yourself into. But this points up the point I wish to make, is that there is a fact of the matter that the church, in fact, is the basis for international maritime admiralty or corporate high seas law, the law of business, period. And the business of money floats all governments. This is why I would recommend and suggest, that governments and institutions under governments, educational institutions, banking institutions, are hesitant to have anything to do with the findings of Christopher or Stephen or any of the other speakers and any of the other many researchers around the world which are on the cutting edge of new technologies and new understandings and new sciences, and also takes in the UFO community. This, I believe, is the reason why governments and institutions of education have for many, many years looked the other way and will not accept the new paradigm. It's because behind international maritime admiralty, corporate business, money, law is the Vatican. And unless and until you understand the thoroughness of what I'm saying, you're never going to understand why governments and educational institutions continually will not and refuse to see the new evidences. It's because the church is at stake. And if the church is at stake, so is money, so is corporate law, so is the whole entire world system, which is based on corporate or canon law. What we have here are a few pioneers who are faced with trying to bring spiritual and intellectual knowledge of the past into a world that is dominated by powerful criminal syndicates. I had an FBI man about 7 years ago, and I was in Los Angeles. He was in another large city in the state of California. I was in Los Angeles, and I got a phone call one day from a FBI man, from an FBI officer, and agent, and he said to me, he said, "We have been watching and listening to you from day one." And I, you know, and he says, "But we have no problem with what you do at this point. you are not considered, and I'm trying to remember how he said this. He said, at this point, you are not considered to be a threat to the authorities. But if that day comes, you will be dealt with accordingly. I said, yes, I understand that. And so he said to me, when you speak harshly of government and banking, which I do, he said, and this is an FBI agent, he said, when you speak harshly in public of government, a certain amount of that is allowable. You know, they don't mind. They're not going to affect anything. They're not going to believe you anyway. And besides, what are they going to do if they did believe you? Right? And he said, but, and this was his words, and I remember him well, because I was really rather scared when he called, because I was not expecting to be talking to an FBI agent. He said, when you, and I take an oath that this was the words that he said, when you speak of the church, what you're talking about is organized crime at the highest level in our country. You're talking about money, political power. So, he says, so as long as you are perceived to be an individual on a soapbox, no one is going to be concerned about you. No one is threatened. But if you begin to be heard, not listened to, but heard, and if that becomes the case that you are becoming known and being heard, then you will be dealt with accordingly. So I want you to know that we in the FBI do not consider you to be a threat. But just know there will come a day if you do succeed in what you're doing. So that was, I already had formulated my own thoughts about, quote, the church, end quote. But at that point, that was startling to hear someone say that. This is not to cast aspersions on the Christian theology. No, as a matter of fact, if you wanted to get serious about Christianity, then I would suggest you start right here with Coptic Christianity, because that's where it all began. And if you really want to get serious about the faith. So I have no problem with the faith. I have a problem with what has become known as the military-industrial complex of business in America. I believe that somewhere along the line, we're going to have to begin to look at all of those institutions that are running the world and the people behind the scenes who own them. I have a very big and a very strong spiritual place in my life for the divine. I have no time for religion, government, big business, etc. But having said all of that, I think the way that I would conclude, again, is that I do not consider myself to be an authority, because I have found that the more that I learn, the more I don't know. And the more it becomes apparent to me that I am merely, like everyone else, on a journey. And from the time that I began this, my quest, my spiritual quest, many, many years ago. And as I said, I've had many experiences that have caused me to be and think the way I do. I have for many, many years been on this quest. 1959 is when I began. So I've been doing this kind of thing for 40 years. But it's only the last 12 years that I've gone public with what I believe is the work that I've been given to do. And I'll clarify that for you. My work, I believe, is not to present an intelligent, detailed presentation, but it is quite simply to confront the organized world and say you're wrong. There are things which you don't know or which you do know that you have concealed, And we need to start thinking in a whole new way about who we are and where we're going. And so I put myself out on the line to do nothing but just that, just calling people's attention to the fact that we do not know everything and that we have better start showing respect for the Spirit and for wisdom. And that wisdom is encoded and being held by priests and the holy men, of which we are privileged to have one among us. And again, I want to thank you for your time and for hearing me. And I think that's it. And if you do have any questions, I'll try and answer them. I have nothing. Yes, sir. Oh, no. Devil is, no, the word devil is simply putting a D in front of the word evil. It becomes devil. God is simply taking an O out of good and it becomes God. You know, God is good and devil is evil. Actually, God, the word God comes from a German Gothic, the German word Goth, G-O-T-H, Gad, Goth. Gives us the word God, and devil is nothing more, as I said, than the personification of evil. So I do not believe in God in the classic sense of the term, or devil in the way it is understood. I do believe that there is a very powerful spirit or a force let loose in the nature of things which has evil as its intent. So I have a very high respect for that. I don't think, though, that... Well, I'll tell you why. Because when I was like 9 years old and I was being confirmed in the Catholic Church, confirmation, a young boy 9 years old gets confirmed. And in the confirmation ceremony, the bishop was officiating. And after the ceremonies were over, he asked the children in the church, and it was a very big affair, because my family was connected to the Vatican, so everybody was there to see my confirmation. And we were warned by the nuns and by the priests, if the bishop asks you, if you have any questions, if you ask any, you know, you're going to get hurt. Just keep your mouth shut and sit and play dumb. Okay? So the bishop asked the children, do you have any questions? So I raised my hand. Nobody else did. I raised my hand and said, yeah, I got a question. And I said, my father works with torches. He's like a welder. Could I take a torch and burn a spirit, burn an angel? And he says, no. And I said, why not? Would it hurt him if I burned him? And he said, well, no. And I said, why not? And he said, well, because you can't burn a spirit. Why not? And he said, well, because fire is a natural phenomenon. It has to have something like wood or paper or something to burn. You can't burn a spirit. And I said, well, then why am I worrying about going to hell if my spirit can't burn? Yeah, and the nuns standing on the side by the church said, you? Heck yeah. So I grew up knowing that the system of theology is a way to control your actions. Blessed are the meek, for they're easy to control. The point being is that we need to understand that spirituality is a very powerful thing, and people need to get in tune with it. I have the highest of respect for the Christian theology, but it has been misrepresented far too far and needs to be redefined. Oh, the black robes. Well, as I said, black was a color associated with the planet Saturn. And Saturn, the Saturnalian influence, incidentally, the planet Saturn influences science, philosophy, politics, government. Saturn, one of the old symbols for, one of the old names for the planet Saturn was L. A long time ago, L was Saturn. And consequently, if your god Saturn has appointed you, you became one of the elect. And of course, the whole spiritual power of El, we today refer to as electricity. That common denominator that makes the juice operate. It's the juice that makes all things operate. Electricity. This is why money is referred to as currency. It's the juice that makes things work. It's a current. And incidentally, as much as I hate banking, I have to admit that the Federal Reserve and the IRS in America are necessary evils given the circumstances under which America exists. It, of course, would be better if neither one existed. But the whole idea is like the breath of Shiva. The breathing out, the breathing in. Everything breathes in and out, in and out. Therefore, the breathing out of the currency is from the Federal Reserve, which prints the money. It's paper that breathes out into society. Now it has to take a breath in, which is the IRS. It's got to be pulled back in and then put out and pull back in. Why? Because it's currency. It's a alternating current. The idea being, of course, is if you just keep putting money out, everything will become totally worthless in a couple of weeks, and the whole system comes falling down, because for the first time, everybody will finally understand it's just paper. So you've got to make it look important by taking it back from people. So it's a breathing in and breathing out. Again, it's just currency. I'm fascinated by the use of words and terms. As a matter of fact, when you go into a courtroom, you will see the judge sits on high. He sits up higher than you. That's so the law can look down on you and you can look up to the law. And the judge is said to sit on the bench or rule from the bench. Look up the word bench. It's a Latin word for bank. So therefore, the judge rules for the bank. This is why you cannot interrupt a church service or a courtroom procedure. You can be arrested for doing both. Why? Because of international maritime law says you cannot in any way interfere with the exchange of money. You're doing business here. A courtroom is a business. The judge rules from the bench or bank. So you're conducting business. Yes. Yes. Sure. Yeah, it's like the gang warfare in Los Angeles or any big city in America. They spray graffiti. Those symbols mean something only to those who are on the same level, only to those people who know how to read the symbols. And I've said for a long time that the words and terms and symbols that are used in our country and throughout the world are like letters of the alphabet. If you put them together, the symbols together, and know what they mean and what they imply, you're never going to figure out who's running what. But I mean, some of the most outrageously, overwhelmingly obvious stuff is occurring in America, and people don't even see it. I mean, you drive by an ARCO and you see ARCO sign in America, the ARCO oil. It's on the angle. It's a square. On the angle. But if you square the square, it becomes the Knights of Malta cross. And so many times you will see symbols and emblems, national coats of arms and heraldry, as I said, and corporate logos. All can be traced back to secret societies, fraternal orders. I mean, it's an amazing world we live in.
Is it chosen consciously or unconsciously?
Say it again. Oh, I think that the people at the top are aware. It's the 99% of the masses that don't even know they're alive, don't know what these symbols mean. So many people just go daily in their chores and have no idea in the world that when you pull into a service station, why there are seven major oil companies, why do they call them the Seven Sisters, why is three so very important, why do we have a trilateral, why is the whole world based on tri or three. There's a lot of things like that that people in the know are obviously aware of. It's just that we aren't. Jim. Thank you. Huh? Go on. That was the flow of the spirit. Yes. Oh well, that's a big subject. Basically, that whole subject is something that is referred to as astral theology. The ancient spiritual interpretation of the ancient mysteries as they are incorporated into our modern day religions. The whole idea about the Son of God, Jesus being the Son, God's Son. In the Oxford Dictionary of the English Language, if you look up the word S-U-N, you will see it was originally from the Germanic, because English is a low form of German. The English language comes from the German. And in the Germanic language, that thing which comes up in the morning is spelled S-O-N-N-E or S-O-N. And this is why your boy, your offspring, is your son. He's the light of your life. He represents life everlasting. Why? Because he will have a son, and his son will have a son, and therefore as long as each son has a son, then there will always be life on the earth. I mean, not for you, but through your lineage. The whole concept is a fascinating study when you get into the symbolism of the sun and how it has been used in modern day governments. I mean, God, dog, if you think about all the symbols and emblems on colleges, universities, schools, police departments, fire departments, all of the emblems in power and education, theology, government that uses the sun. The sun is used everywhere. Truly it is the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. The sun. And he dies with the crown of thorns, of course, like the Statue of Liberty with a crown of thorns. It's a sunburst, the corona. That's why a king is made king at a coronation. It comes from the word corona. He is crowned with the glory of the sun. He had 12 helpers, or 12 followers. Of course, the 12 followers were nothing more than the 12 signs of the zodiac, or the 12 hours of day. He took 12 steps across heaven. Horus did, or the sun, went 12 steps across heaven. 12 different Horuses, spelled H-O-R-U-S. We turn it around, it becomes 12 hours, H-O-U-R-S. Horus in the beginning was rising, you know. And we still say Horus is rising this morning. You know, he comes up on the Horus rising. And at night he goes down and he becomes the evil brother. And the evil brother was called Set. And so we see the evil brother come out at night and he comes out at sunset. It's a fascinating play on words. But the bottom line, and I'm not the authority on theology, but the bottom line, I believe, on all of this going back into the ancient world can be nailed down to one simple concept: the war between light and darkness. Period. Intellectual and spiritual darkness, and the war between darkness and the coming of new light. New light, and light has always had to fight off the forces of darkness. We still are. We're still trying to do that. We have great authors and great teachers and men who are trying to bring intellectual and enlightenment to a world filled with darkness. Incidentally, the Bible has Jesus making an interesting statement. Something to the effect that if you say that you are in the light, but in fact you are in the dark, then how dark your light really is. Interesting concept. And that was something caught me many years ago. If you say that you are intellectually enlightened, but in point of fact, you're not. You're actually in the dark. Then how dark your light really is. Meaning that it would be better for you to say that you know nothing, because everyone knows you know nothing. God knows that you know nothing. And it would be better for you to admit going in that you know nothing. Then there's room now for you to become enlightened. But if you say that you're in the light, then the divine is saying to you, I hope you are. Because if we find out you're not, you got some serious problems. So you come on up here and you show me how much light you say you got. And you better have it. Because if you play dumb and act like what you really are, ill-informed and unread, and if you really are humble, then there's room to invite you to come into the light. But if you've already got it, then there's no room for hope for you. So I think that this is a very safe place for us to be. Assume we do not know virtually anything about the divine and listen to those who are trying to help us to enlighten us spiritually. And again, I draw the attention to a holy man that's with us today. Yes, Green. Yeah. Yes.
For the positive, it's been a very bittersweet journey, I think, and I am grateful that you pointed out that the real keys are within we as beings, as Zesh, and that's the only time we'll know when it's ready to start opening. But it's there. I mean, it's coming because we're considering things in our own personal philosophies that 6 months ago, 6 years ago, 10 years ago, we'd never entertaining the notion.
That's right.
And I would like some of the frustration. It's like, you know, if your 5-year-old wants to fly a jet, they want to fly a plane, you don't just have the keys. So I'm grateful for you mentioning that. And I just have to say, because I can't help it with my area, that before three biblical implementation traditions, matriarchal.
Genesis 6:1 makes an interesting statement. I don't know. Maybe I'm reading something into it that's not there. Genesis 6:1 says, and when men began to multiply upon the face of the earth, and daughters were born unto them. And you look at the word men, and it means just that, men. And daughters? Well, first of all, how did men begin to multiply on the face of the earth without women? And second of all, how were daughters born unto them? I'm not sure. But I'll tell you, there's just an awful lot in the Bible that we do not correctly understand. In the beginning, in Genesis 1:14, and this is one of my favorite subjects of occultism in the Bible. In Genesis 1:14, the Bible says that God created the sun and the moon and the stars, and they were called the lesser luminaries, and it says, and let them, the stars, the moon and the sun, let them serve as signs, comma, and for seasons and for years. The word signs is from a Hebrew word for horoscope, zodiac. So let them serve as signs. In Hebrew, the word signs was horoscope. Then when you begin to go in through the Bible and see that there will be great signs in the heavens and great signs from God, always the word in the Old Testament Hebrew was signs in relation to astrological, zodiological signs. I think there is a profound amount of evidence to show that both the Old and New Testament is nothing more than a profoundly highly tuned and highly honed understanding of astrology. And unless and until we are able to appreciate that the planets affect us, we're never going to figure out why things are the way they are. We are aware, for instance, we are aware that the moon is able to pull the tides of the earth. The tides are caused by the moon. The moon has the ability to pull water. Since you're over 90% water yourself, could it affect you? We know it affects the cycle in a female. The moon does. We know that there are cycles that the ancients knew when to plant and when not to plant. All of the holy days in the ancient Hebrew system were based on agriculture, the harvest, the cycles of the moon, the new moon, the full moon, etc. So if the moon is able to pull the tides of the earth, then maybe it also affects you, and that's why they call you a lunatic. Also, I don't know if you know this or not, this was an interesting point that I found out not too long ago, that the planet Jupiter actually pulls the sun 3 degrees out of orbit wherever it goes. The point, for my understanding, is that if Jupiter here, the sun has moved 3 degrees closer to it. When it's over here, it has moved 3 degrees this way. When it's back here, it moves 3 degrees this way. The idea is that the planet Jupiter exerts enough gravitational force field on the sun to pull it 3 degrees out of orbit. If that is true, then that tells me that the planet Jupiter is a very powerful influence on the rest of the solar system, not to mention all the other planets. Well, if it can affect the sun, maybe Jupiter affects you. Maybe we are affected when we come out of our mother's water. Maybe we are affected the moment we are born with influences that we're not even aware of. I mean, the whole idea of your mother's water breaking and you coming out into a new life, you've been surrounded by water and protected, but coming out into the world for the first time, you know, we're being bombarded by all kinds of rays and television and radio and all the other rays that we have produced. Well, what about the influences of the planets? Do they affect us? According to the Bible, they do. And according to my personal belief, they do. It doesn't matter if it does or not. I believe they do. And I think a very good case can be made for it. And again, the Bible makes that case. Yes. Oh, yes. Well, in relation to the big shots putting a capstone on the pyramid, I think it's a waste of their time. I don't think that divine presence in the universe gives a damn. Thing may blow up on them. Yeah. Yes. Right.